Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It was in the 1950s when courts decided that nudity was no longer equal to obscenity in movies. From those decisions, a genre of film known as sexploitation emerged and became a cottage industry while other parts of the film world were declining. Many of those films flew under the radar by presenting their subjects in a narrative context. Films we might term softcore today span many different genres, most commonly the sex melodrama.
Until very recently, the sexploitation films of the 1960s were largely overlooked or dismissed by film scholars. Elena Gorfinkel is working to change the perception of this decade in film. Gorfinkel is a former UW-Milwaukee professor who now teaches film studies at King's College London.
Her new book is called Lewd Looks, American Sexploitation Cinema in the 1960s, and it takes a deep dive into the salacious independent films made on the margins of Hollywood.
Gorfinkel talks about the book in Milwaukee this evening, but first she joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and explained the film's unique characteristics and larger impact on American culture.
The films are incredibly preoccupied with female sexual autonomy in this period, and they progressed from fairly chaste exposure to kind of more explicit and more simulated sex scenarios by the late 60s. And the films themselves are also quite porous in that they would be a cycle of films about swingers, about the counterculture, about LSD, so that in many ways they would just absorb aspects of the culture and kind of pastiche it into stories that would work. The films were made on average $10,000 to $40,000, very low budget, and would be usually made on over a week's time with relatively unknown actors, and so that they had their appeal was quite different from the Hollywood film in a variety of ways. But they're really quite interesting documents about a particular era's fantasies and anxieties about gender and sexuality and the autonomy of women in particular in a new order, in a new kind of economy and environment.
Exactly. And these films were made in the margin of Hollywood, which was an industry that had to change post-war. You know, it was no longer the big primary viewership of the silver screen. Mm-hmm. What new factors in entertainment and society during the 1960s was the classic Hollywood silver screen competing against that allowed these films to kind of surface in the margins?
Mm-hmm. Well, Hollywood production was declining, and it actually goes back all the way to, say, the mid-40s and the late 40s. There was a particular case against Hollywood, an antitrust case. It was called the Paramount decision, and that radically changed the industry in conjunction with the impact of television. And so the Paramount decision forced the studios to divest their holdings in exhibition, meaning they couldn't have a monopoly all the way down, what was called vertical integration. And so they had to sell off their theater holdings. And that meant that theaters would sit kind of empty as kind of Hollywood production declined, because they were also kind of trying to remain competitive, but people were doing different things with their free time in the 50s and in that kind of era of suburbanization in the U.S., drawing audiences in terms of forms of entertainment. So I think Hollywood felt it had to compete in a variety of ways. Hollywood, you know, also was seeing like the golden era of the studio period with kind of less capital, with less productions, was kind of becoming more tarnished. And the kind of big stars that one associated with Hollywood. Also, there was just a very different ethos emerging about stardom, too, that I think really contrasts in a really productive way with what sexploitation films offered. Because sexploitation films, like a filmic version of Playboy magazine or other kind of men's magazines, really offered this sense of this unvarnished girl next door, whereas I think Hollywood films, you know, there's still kind of holding on to stars like Liz Taylor, Audrey Hepburn, Natalie Wood. They were very much a kind of very different model of like femininity being proffered. But there obviously were, you know, they were contending with similar things. But I think the question of mature content and sexual explicitness and nudity were happening in Hollywood. And Hollywood was really trying to distinguish itself from these emergent films that were circulating and trying, you know, Hollywood is trying to characterize sexploitation films as really like, you know, these are these fly-by-night operators that are ruining it for us. We're trying to have a respectable business. But what sexploitation offered is that they were outside of the province of the code, and so that they didn't have to subscribe to the same premises as Hollywood films did. So there was this kind of area of contest and transformation going on in the 60s that really highlights the difference between Hollywood films and the more crass or more vulgar, the kind of the sense of the felt explicitness of what sexploitation films offered.
Right. And with its offerings, of course, would draw a new kind of audience that was going away from the classic mm-hmm. cinema. As you mentioned, it was kind of the revival of the neighborhood cinema. These adults-only cinemas mm-hmm. were kind of an open secret. So what were the target audiences mm-hmm. for sexploitation films? You know, was it yeah. men and women or primarily men?
These are films made by men, largely for men, but the audience does shift in the mid to late 60s as there's much more of a, you know, the culture is becoming more permissive. And also we have, you know, their sexuality is also very visible in foreign films and, you know, import films. And so, and obviously this is, you know, we have the counterculture and this obviously a movement towards some of the, you know, elements of what we associate with like the sexual revolution. So that I think a couple's audience becomes quite significant for sexploitation films, particularly in urban areas. And I think the films do then circulate by the late 60s in interesting ways, but not without contest and not without some protest. It's a really interesting time period, too, to think about the changing nature of the film audience itself and the way that the film audience is also bracketing. And I do talk a lot about both the idea of the audience, but also the like actual audiences that saw the films and talked about and wrote about watching the films in the book.
Yeah, you just mentioned, you know, they're kind of like time capsules, these films, but mm-hmm. largely at the time they're made with such a quick turnover, it was almost mm-hmm. a throwaway film. So I'm curious, did you have difficulties researching this and finding these films when they were considered one and done?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that's a really important part of understanding the films that were made on this very fast turnaround, both in terms of production and sometimes in terms of exhibition. Sometimes the films would get repackaged and then you'd see them a few years later in a slightly different form and a more, you know, with added footage perhaps. So there are these strange ways the films are kind of anachronistic in a variety of ways where they kind of are like of their time and very contemporary, but then they also seem sometimes belated. But researching them was interesting because, I mean, these films don't exist in any single archive, you know, whereas a Hollywood film, you know, you can go to the Margaret Herrick Library or, you know, the American Film Institute and you can find films, you know, of a particular filmmaker or of a particular body of work in an archive. But these films actually were largely recovered by amateur historians and fans and collectors who collected the films and actually created independent, for-profit businesses in selling them on video. One of the most significant companies was Something Weird Video. So when I first started this, I was watching these films on VHS, bootlegging them on VHS mm-hmm. from my local video store and consuming them that way. And now they've kind of moved on to DVD, not without losses and licensing issues. So it's a very spotty and unruly archive. There is something important about preservation in thinking about these films because of their kind of cultish, almost like bad movie qualities. They often, you know, are not treated as seriously as other forms of cinema. And I think that has worked to their detriment. And it's it would be incredible to have an actual institutionally affiliated archive that held them. But it created challenges because, you know, there were no places to go and look at all the papers. Usually filmmakers didn't, you know, think their films had value. So a lot of times, if filmmakers or producers would just get rid of films, get rid of their papers, and all of that, those trails had to be reconstructed. So I was very interested to think about what their impact was in a public sphere of film culture, and that was my approach and a way of dealing with some of those gaps and some of those difficulties of that, you know, the spottiness of that archive. But other people have done quite a lot of oral history as well and interviewing folks. And so that also is an important aspect with people are still, you know, there's a way that is very, very, very pronounced graying of the people and kind of, you know, a lot of people have passed away. And so that aspect of it is also quite important to keep that history alive.
Do you see the views of coming at this through a scholarly perspective or even a public one shift because, mm-hmm. you know, America is still rather Puritan in what it thinks is acceptable, either for historical preservation or anything else. But do you see the tide turning as you were diving into this project?
Yeah, there is a, I think there is somewhat of a tide turning. I think it has to do with these kind of younger but commercial entities and companies that are, and younger kind of amateur historians that are interested in it. But I do think that at the, there does need to be a place that kind of a more kind of institutional recognition. That was also the importance of doing this book in this way in terms of scale and approach. Certainly, I do think the tide is shifting to some degree, but I think in some ways public perception and a kind of perception of the what is the obscene in some ways is predeterminative and overdetermining, and it in some ways becomes forbidding. So I think there is, it's quite easy, especially in our highly hypermediated and accelerated moment, to write things off and to have a hot take and then to bracket things off. And our time feels much more pressurized. So I think to sit down with one of these films as opposed to a film by Cassavetes, or who was not, you know, it was like kind of in this geographically, working in a geographically proximate world, and one can think about ways an independent film tradition is working alongside, and these are independent films. So I think that those are kind of challenges in making these films exciting or interesting to look into for a wider audience, or to kind of for them to be taken seriously.
What do you think its lasting impact was on the portrayal of women in film?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that in some ways there was a kind of continuity of what sexploitation films did in relationship to the way that obviously the important feminist critique of a critic like Laura Mulvey about the male gaze and about female spectacle is certainly what she wrote after these, you know, she wrote at 1975. And in some ways, in one way, one could say these films anatomize that argument. They really make that really quite visible, that here we have this way that the, you know, female sexuality becomes quite literally the form of spectacle that is really at the heart of cinema. On the other hand, I think the films are interesting in their ability to document kind of like the everyday habits and comportment and like the ways of being feminine of a kind of, you know, of a range of women that we wouldn't normally see in cinema. So I think there's something about the way that the films preserve that that is quite important, that is less about kind of an affirmative representation or a positive representation or a negative representation. I think it's interesting to think about, to take seriously, like the notion that like some, you know, like these women wanted to act in films, and they, many of them took their work, you know, seriously and were proud of it. Some were not. But I think that it's important to think about labor, women's labor and performance in film. And I think that that is something the films make us think about in interesting ways in relationship to sex. If we think only in terms of like positive or negative representations, then the films aren't necessarily legible or interesting. I think their legacy is, in a way, a lot about America. It's like, it's much very linked to kind of the fundamental anxiety and ambivalent relationship American culture has to female sexuality. And so that they make that quite clear. I don't think that's in any way been resolved
right
in the contemporary moment. But I think in some ways that because they were so brash, they offered something very different, you know, in the sense that they, there's something about the force of the expression. Like here is this sudden, like female sexuality was like this detonating force. Like earlier you mentioned Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, a very kind of significant film by Russ Meyer. And there, like the women are these insane badasses who are, you know, and they in some ways become, you know, these feminist icons in cult circles. And like, then I think it's interesting to think about the nuances of the way in which women appear, kind of how, you know, how is it that we understand what a woman's body means in cinema? So in that respect, they're quite interesting.
Right. You mentioned they kind of exist in an interesting juxtaposition or contradictory nature, and how they can be viewed as a positive portrayal or pro-feminism or other things like that. But then also looking at today in juxtaposition, today's political climate, and also all of the sexual harassment scandals that have been become quite public and have changed the dialogue of, you know, the value of women and still the issue of women's sexuality and other things like that. So how did you view your research and these films in today's post-Weinstein scandal and larger cultural significance.
Right. I mean, I think that it's been quite interesting to see. It's unraveling and unfolding as we speak, but it's really quite incredible to in the way that Harvey Weinstein and after has played out and the kinds of the sense of consciousness that it has introduced in a very public sphere. Thinking about these films in that context, I think it reinforces the sense in which that they're like, I think for me that the films are not necessarily the cause, but they're the symptom of a larger infrastructure of inequality. At the same time, I think it makes the work of close reading and the work of historical research, the work of reading women's stories in these films even more pressing in a variety of ways, because I think there's a double thing that happens, that it's like at the same time that one says, like, well, the woman becomes an object and she's only an object, in some ways it's discounting that woman's labor and that woman as a person who acted and worked and had certain conditions of work. There is a way of approaching those questions historically that I think are very productive and can both work in the space of critique and to challenge the patriarchy at the same time as embracing forms of sexual expressivity that are outside the norm and outside of a kind of puritanical framework, right? I mean, certainly I would consider myself like a pro-sex feminist as a product of those debates in the 80s and 90s about pornography. And so I think it's quite important to look at these works closely and to take them seriously, what regardless of what position you take on them. But to take them seriously means to actually watch them and to engage with them as meaningful texts.
Elena Gorfinkel is the author of Lewd Looks, American Sexploitation Cinema in the 1960s. She's a senior lecturer in film studies at King's College in London, England. She formerly taught film at UW-Milwaukee, and she is back in town to talk about her new book this evening at Boswell Book Company.